move to the second case this morning, Victims of Hungarian Holocaust versus Hungarian Railways.
May it please the Court, my name is Conrad Kelter, and I represent the Hungarian National Railways. This appeal does not involve any of the collateral appended appellate jurisdiction questions that the prior appeal involved. The sole question in this case is, did the district court err in finding that the allegations in the plaintiff's amended complaint supported the application of the expropriation exception to the Hungarian National Railway's sovereign immunity? For several reasons, the answer to that question is he did err. First, there was no violation of international law stated in the plaintiff's complaint. Second, the allegations in the plaintiff's complaint do not establish that the Hungarian National Railways currently owns or operates any of the property that was taken over six decades ago or its proceeds. Third, the allegations in the amended complaint do not show that the Hungarian National Railways is engaged in business in the United States. And finally, were the expropriation exception to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act to be applied to the Hungarian National Railways in this case, it would conflict with the procedures that were set forth in the 1947 treaty on how to resolve claims regarding reparations involving at the end of World War II in Hungary. Let me first talk for a moment about the international law, that no international law violation. Counsel for the bank addressed some of the specifics of that issue, and I won't dwell on it, but I don't think that all the cases that we cited in our brief and in the bank's brief lay out that every court, both at the district court level and the appellate court level, have found that the taking of a sovereign of its own sovereign own national's property does not constitute a violation of international law. Now, Your Honor, to your question about the Dicas Bell case, I think that one of the differences and one of the things, with all due respect to the judge, that she overlooked was the issue of whether or not a national has all the rights of a citizen of that country or not begs the question. The issue is there a national or some other country's sovereignty impinged by the taking? And I respectfully submit in the Dicas Bell case, there was not. And clearly, in this case, you also don't have that impingement on the sovereignty of any other nation. And that is a critical issue that's needed for an international law violation. And it is true that as the international law has developed, there have been certain very narrow exceptions to that rule, but none of them apply to the taking of property. And so, therefore, I submit that the plaintiffs have not made they cannot show that an exception to the expropriation exception applies to the Hungarian sovereign or Hungarian National Railways in this case.
Well, I guess the problem is how absolute is that rule? You're telling us it's absolute. Some of these opinions use words like generally, and plaintiffs are arguing this is unique. This was not, for example, the seizure, the refusal to honor a check for $150,000 after the Nicaraguan government changed. This is not expropriation of one bank. This is part of a genocidal enterprise.
Well, Your Honor, in that regard, the issue that you have to separate, I believe, is the issue of the taking of property and the issue of genocide. Now, the law...
If you separate them,
I think you do, because I think what we're talking about here is the application of the exceptions in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And as this court has taught in both the Haven case and the Sampson case, they have to be those exceptions have to be narrowly interpreted. And in this case, the expropriation exception deals solely with the taking of property. There are other exceptions within the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act that deal with torts and, in fact, deal with terrorism. Neither of those exceptions in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act apply in this case. And I don't believe that any of the cases that are cited by plaintiff really show that there is an exception to this rule, that in the domestic taking context, you don't have a violation of international law. So, Your Honor, unless you have any other questions on that issue, I believe that between the bank's counsel and the argument now, that I would like to move on to the issue of whether or not the allegations in the plaintiff's complaint show that the Hungarian National Railways still owns or operates the property that was taken over six decades ago. And I suggest to the court that the only allegations in the complaint about retention of the property is the sole words, they retain the property today. That, under the Iqbal analysis, is simply a legal conclusion or a restatement of what the statute says. And
I retain the property. Is that a factual assertion?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that under the Iqbal analysis, that is not. It's simply a restatement of what the statute says. Now, there are no factual allegations as to how is that retention. What is retained? Where is the property? Who has it? There's nothing that's said in the complaint about that. And in any event, even if you were to look at that allegation, it's just not, under the Iqbal analysis, it's not plausible that the property may still be in their possession, or the proceeds of that property may still be in the Hungarian National Railway's possession.
Why is that not plausible?
Well,
same entity, 60 years later. Where did the money or property go, if not with you guys?
Well, but the issue, Your Honor, I think is threefold. First of all, one of the properties that we're allegedly talking about was credits that they received from Germany or the Nazi regime. Well, clearly, those would not exist today. Second of all, you're talking about cash, which is a fungible asset. And how do you show that that same cash that they got 60 years ago, if they indeed received that cash, is still with the railroad today? You've had three different regime changes, or at least three regime changes in terms of governments in Hungary. You've had at least two reorganizations of the Hungarian National Railways over the past 60 years. So there are a number of factual issues which I think show that the plausibility of whether that property is still retained today is in question. And I think another issue is the Hungarian gold train. I think it's without
that
dispute.
That seems to invite a lot of speculation on our part. Let me ask you, if we were to agree with you on the adequacy of the pleading of this issue, would there be any reason why the plaintiffs would not be entitled to an opportunity to replead to address those deficiencies that might be found, since after all they've won so far?
Mm-hmm. Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that under Iqbal they're entitled to
remanded to allow an opportunity to replead.
I don't believe Iqbal remanded for an opportunity to replead. What it said was that They haven't, you don't, until you've made a plausible case, or at least as to...
In Iqbal itself, the case was remanded to the lower courts to decide whether to allow repleting. And when a complaint has survived until the very first time somebody says there's a problem with it, we ordinarily have a pretty liberal policy towards amending pleadings.
Your Honor, I think at least in...
Is there a reason we should not, if we agree with you on this point, is there a reason we should not allow repleting?
Well, yes, Your Honor. I believe there's a reason, and it really goes to the treaty exception, which they cannot plead around, and that is you look at the 1947 treaty. And what the 1947 treaty did was it made Hungary solely responsible for reparations following the war. And to the extent that there were issues or objections to what Hungary was doing with regarding to those reparations, Article 40 of the treaty spelled out a resolution proceeding. The first thing that it said was you will have diplomatic negotiations to resolve any disputes regarding the reparations process. And to the extent that diplomatic negotiations did not achieve what you needed, then there was a process for setting up a commission among the heads of the mission of the United States, Britain, and Russia, as well as the UN General Council, for setting up a commission to resolve those disputes of reparations under the treaty. And what Section 1604 of the FSIA says is that to the extent any exceptions in the FSIA conflict with an existing treaty at the time of the enactment of the FSIA, the treaty prevails. In this case, the FSIA was enacted in 1976, and there's no dispute that the treaty of 1947 was signed in 1947 and was ratified by the Senate in 1947. So clearly the 1947 treaty was in existence well before the FSIA was enacted. If, in fact, this court were to allow claims of the appellees to proceed in this court, it would conflict with that resolution process that was set up in the 1947 treaty. So, Your Honor, I believe that that is something that the plaintiffs or the appellees cannot plead around, and so it would be futile to remand to allow the plaintiffs discovery on that issue. Going back briefly to the expropriation exception, there was one last point that I did want to talk about briefly, and that is the issue of whether or not they've sufficiently pled that the Hungarian National Railways is engaged in a business activity or a commercial activity in the United States. They've really only said three things. They've said that you can order tickets to the Hungarian National Railways, that there's advertising by the Hungarian National Railways, and that the Hungarian National Railways accepts American currency and American credit cards. Well, the fact of the matter is there's nothing said about where those activities take place, and if what they're discussing, and they weren't specific about this, is that you can go onto the Internet and get on MAV's website, that I don't believe is sufficient to show that there's any type of commercial activity that Hungarian National Railways is engaging in the United States. And the fact of the matter is the Hungarian National Railways runs the railways in Hungary. It provides no services here in the United States. And in addition, below, on that point of commercial activity in the United States, the Hungarian National Railways did submit a declaration of its chief executive officer in which he said the Hungarian Railways does not engage in business or commercial activities here in the United States. In response, in below, the plaintiffs made no attempt to try to rebut that declaration by coming forth with any factual evidence. And they're not allowed.
Was there any discovery done or allowed on the relationship between MAV and your, is it START subsidiary that does the passenger services?
No, Your Honor. There was no discovery done below.
Was any sought?
I don't believe. Well, I believe that there may have been one reference at some point in one of the briefs of the appellees below that they should be entitled to discovery, but I don't believe it was
served.
No discovery was served, Your Honor. The only thing that took place in the court below was briefing on the motions to dismiss. And finally, Your Honor, before I sit down, the last point I would like to make is, to the extent that the court were inclined at all to allow any claims to proceed under the expropriation exception, which I don't think they should given everything that I've argued, but to the extent that the non-property taking claims they should be dismissed because, as this court has said, you must construe the exceptions very narrowly. And in this case, the issues of genocide and conspiracy to commit genocide, they have nothing to do with the expropriation exception, and therefore, at a minimum, those claims should be dismissed. And I believe I've reached the end of my time, so unless the court has any questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Leon.
Thank you, Your Honor. Jeff Leon, again, for the victims of the Hungarian Holocaust against the National Railway. In the last case, we talked about collateral order review, but we only talked about it in the context of one of the requirements, which was finality. Another requirement is that the matter has to be truly collateral. And what distinguishes this case from almost every other FSIA case under the collateral order doctrine is that this is a case under the takings exception and not the commercial activities or commercial participation exception to immunity. Here, the question of whether the taking was in violation of international law is a jurisdictional requirement to determine whether immunity exists. But it is also, unlike in the commercial activities exception, a substantive aspect of liability, which is, did they violate international law? Because if they didn't violate international law, then our plaintiffs would have no claim. So this case is wholly unlike the other cases where there has been immediate review of an FSIA claim. The commercial activities exception, just to refamiliarize the court with it, deals with instances where the sovereign is acting as a commercial entity, almost like a private company. And in that case, the jurisdictional requisites don't require first determining whether a violation of international law occurred in order to pierce sovereign immunity, whereas here, under the takings exception, it must. Therefore, there is no collateral order appeal. The other element we didn't discuss is effective unreviewability. Being subjected to some more litigation on issues limited to sovereign immunity is not a harm that is of the type that would require immediate review. As this court noted in Karami, and again, I'm not going to talk about Karami in terms of its finality, but in terms of the effective unreviewability requirement, the court referred to a Supreme Court case called Johnson versus Jones. And granted, this is in the context of qualified immunity, but it said that, as Johnson holds, when the existence of a qualified immunity turns on facts particular to a given case, the district court has tools available that will allow it to preserve the defendant's right to a speedy determination whether he or she must bear the burdens of litigation, while at the same time allowing plaintiffs with colorable claims to proceed with their complaints. So in other words, what the court said, if you think that there was a final determination, was that there were fact issues, we could have a fact proceeding limited to those issues. So there is no effective unreviewability. That's very important. And also, I would note that with regard to effective unreviewability, I would argue that the concern in qualified immunity cases is actually greater than in the FSIA cases, because the courts have actually said that what you want to do is free public officials from being burdened with a lawsuit like this while they're trying to carry out their job responsibilities. Thus, there's a temporal element that's built into that concern that does not exist in the FSIA case. And the question of immunity, if the burdening of the sovereign of Hungary would impair the foreign relations of the U.S. and Hungary, then maybe you might have an argument that it's akin to the qualified immunity concern expressed in all that line of cases. But the State Department's been notably silent about the lawsuit as it applies to the Hungarian sovereigns. There's not been a word. And by the way, I think that's significant with regard to the treaties argument that they make. They want to interpret the treaties, but the State Department hasn't come in saying that this court must defer to these treaties or that not deferring to the treaties would harm the foreign interests of the United States. And I would note that's kind of important, and it relates to the jurisdictional issues because while Mr. Kalto argued the treaties argument, he didn't note that they didn't raise the argument below. Their brief does, but he didn't note that, and that's important because as this court said in Karami, the fact that appellate review from decisions to dismiss cases under 12b-6 is de novo does not mean litigants are entitled to bypass the district court altogether. We find it procedurally unacceptable to rule on the sufficiency of the complaint through the back door, using the government's theory that a complaint that fails to allege a constitutional violation clearly enough to satisfy Twombly is all that it needs in order to appeal. There were a lot of fact issues concerning these treaties, and he said we can't plead around it. I respectfully submit that we did, pretty clearly in our complaint, paragraph 52 of our complaint through all the way through paragraph 59, directly address the two treaties and point out how they're of limited application and how Hungary has been in breach of those treaties almost as soon as they were executed. Now, if the district court had been presented with this on a facial Rule 12 challenge, which is really all that we have in front of us, these facts have to be taken as true, and these treaties have no meaning. So this is not appropriate for a pendant jurisdiction appeal, which is how they're trying to get this issue before the court. He said we can't plead around it. We've already pled around it. And even if you think we haven't, these are fact issues, whether Hungary has been in breach of its obligations, whether the 1973 treaty has any application beyond people who were U.S. citizens at the time of World War II. Not one of our plaintiffs was a U.S. citizen at the time of World War II, but that's what the 1973 treaty deals with. I also want to talk about the commercial activity exception, because this is very important. They're trying to conflate the commercial activity element of the takings exception with personal jurisdiction under the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution. And the courts have been clear that they are not the same, not remotely the same. In fact, to the point where the Ninth Circuit in Casseray found that the same defendant challenging personal jurisdiction and commercial activities under the Versailles taking were not inextricably intertwined such that pendant jurisdiction could be exercised. There's no quantum of significance to the context, to the commercial context. It does not have to meet due process requirements. It just has to be regular commercial activity. You don't have to be physically present. MOV regularly sells its tickets in the U.S. through an agent. It markets its products, its services through the U.S. It wants people in the U.S. who are planning a trip to Hungary to pre-purchase tickets to ride on the MOV service. It wants that to occur. That, all by itself, is enough under the law that we cite in our brief. And if the court, I would refer the court to pages 35 through 38 of our response brief. And there's not a mention of this. Instead, what Mr. Kalto does is stand up and basically say, it's personal jurisdiction. It's not even close. Their personal jurisdiction is established by the effectiveness of service under, which is something that's governed by the FSIA statute. So we respectfully submit that there is no jurisdiction for this court to take either issue on appeal. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Dillon. Mr. Pavich. That's fine. Yes.
If it pleases the court, Your Honor, my name is Richard Weisberg, and I am, like my colleagues, representing the plaintiffs in the action that they have brought against the Hungarian National Railroad. I want to address with some specificity the two elements of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act exception that have been especially at issue here. There are actually four requirements to prove the exception. Only two have been cast into question strongly by counsel today. One of them has been the allegation that dominant case law requires that a takings, in order to be a violation of international law, has got to be from individuals who are not considered citizens. They also flirted with, in their papers, with the concept of nationals within the jurisdiction. We take issue on the law with that, but I want to introduce to the court in a literal sense, in addressing that particular issue, two direct victims of the genocidal conduct of the Hungarian National Railroad who are with us in the court today. One, Paul Fisher, was shoved at the age of seven into a MAV cattle car. He had been given by his mother and aunt, as well as his, they gave to his three brothers, certain personal property that the older generation hoped against hope could be preserved from a pattern of spoliation that had taken place during these deportations. But, in fact, the railroad took valuable property even from this seven-year-old. The other of our respected clients who was in the court today is Magda Brown, who on her 17th birthday was deported from the ghetto in Miskolc to Auschwitz on a train of the defendant railroad. And there's a third person who's not here, but who is specifically, whose story is specifically described in our papers, directly relevant to the claim that Hungarian nationals or citizens, we think a spurious definition under the circumstances, exclusively were the target of the takings and the expropriation. And that is our client, Yehudit Bara, whose story is mentioned in paragraph 17 of our amended complaint. Yehudit Bara was not a Hungarian. Like many of our clients, she was born in Romania. There are significant factual issues about the scope of the Hungarian genocide. They've been raised by both sides, actually, today. Greater Hungary encompassed states and also citizens and nationals of states that were not, in fact, in Hungary itself. And many of those were taken from wherever they were geographically and moved to places where the Hungarian National Railroad was in a position to deport them. Opposing counsel in the Mod case earlier this morning mentioned the Freund case, with which I'm quite familiar, which was a case brought in the Second Circuit against the French National Railroad, and stated, and that was true, that while the preponderance of those who were victimized in an almost identical way, in a directly genocidal way, by the French National Railroad, who were the defendants in those cases, while most of the plaintiffs were French at the time of the deportations, that did not bother the court. It did not bother the Second Circuit. It was not in any way a deal breaker to their claim. And part of the reason, but only part of the reason for that, was because many of those who were deported on the French National Railroad, as is true in our case against the Hungarian National Railroad, were in fact citizens or nationals of other countries. And to take that one step further, the distinction really that's being looked at here has got to be tested against what it is to be the target of a genocidal policy. A genocidal policy does not envision the retention of status as either a citizen or a state. It does not envision the retention of any human status elements. What it has in mind is the complete stripping of the individual of every quality except the hated quality that is being targeted. And in Hitler's Europe, that hated quality was the quality of being Jewish. To make distinctions among those who were victimized by that classic, targeted, hideous policy on the basis of citizenship or nationality is, it seems to me, inapposite and runs against, really, the policy and history of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And there's really nothing in the Act itself that indicates that that distinction should be made. Furthermore, Disapel, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, we've all struggled with that. That's the recent case, barely 4 months old, that was decided in the District Court of the District of Columbia, is by no means an outlier. And I would predict, given other District of Columbia cases, that that case will be affirmed. But it relied on a different pattern of understanding of this that was already ensconced, particularly in Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals cases such as West v. Multibanco. West v. Multibanco, we cite that case, and Casiro in the Ninth Circuit, that instead of looking formalistically and, we think, inappositely at the status of individuals, citizen, national, or really stateless, which is what most of these hapless victims became over time, those earlier cases just looked directly at international law and principles of international law and adopted a three-step test, which we would strongly ask this court to adopt. That is, first of all, was the taking, was the expropriation in the service of any public purpose? Typically not. Were the takings affected from a discriminatory purpose redolent of some specific prejudice? Definitely. And thirdly, was there compensation? And of course, there has been no compensation of the takings in these particular cases.
Professor, I could just ask one question. If that's the test, you're familiar probably with the Kelo against City of New London case.
Yes.
I'm going to embellish it a little bit, but let's suppose you've got a local government deciding there's a blighted neighborhood. Maybe the property is targeted because of race, ethnicity, religion. Property is taken arguably not for a public purpose. Local government, or the American courts deny compensation. Can that be pursued as a question of international law?
Well, Your Honor, Kelo, of course, has been quite controversial. We think the facts are sharply distinguishable from the very dramatic facts.
I'm asking about the test you're proposing.
Which is not my test. It's a test that has been used by other courts of appeals, actually, in viewing this situation. Well, I think the third prong, which is has there been adequate compensation, if I recall correctly, was met
actually,
in Kelo.
That doesn't even matter, because under your test, if it's not taken for a public purpose or if it's discriminatory, that's a violation of international law, correct?
Well, it's a three-prong test.
And any of those is enough, right?
Granted, Your Honor, but what might distinguish Kelo is that there was immediate compensation under our classic eminent domain.
Yeah,
In this case, property is taken for discriminatory purposes, no compensation.
Professor, the problem with your test is you've argued that any one of those three prongs is enough to make it a violation of international law.
Then I misspoke. It's a three-part test. All three have to be met. That was my mistake. I'm just citing the cases from the Ninth Circuit, West versus Montebank. All three of those have to be met in order for there to be a violation of international law. So there's a paradigm shift. Instead of looking at the beleaguered individuals and saying, were you a citizen or were you not a citizen, in an environment in citizenship and other status were being programmatically stripped from these individuals. That line of cases, which is indeed, I think, picked up by D. Zappel, which is a very, very carefully drawn opinion, that line of cases also exists in contradistinction to some that take what we call the formalistic view, which we feel is inappropriate. I might also add, if I could, Your Honor, at this stage, that the vast majority of cases in looking at pleadings on a motion to dismiss procedure accept the first three prongs of the requirements of the exception that we are alleging here, as long as they are adequately pled. And I would cite Agudas Hasidai Chabad, a D.C. District Court of 08, Garb, Seidemann, Zappia. Remember, we're on a motion to dismiss.
Thank you.
Here. May I make one other point, Your Honor? All right. 30 seconds to address the statements that they made about the fraud.
Quiet open.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Lost track. Do I have 5 minutes, 4 minutes, Ernest?
Five minutes.
I'll be done in five. Justice, I don't believe that our complaint, Your Honors, can be read in any way reasonably read and conclude that the takings here was not a taking that violated international law. Expropriation, the takings, it seems as though counsel is suggesting that all we've done is plead takings, and we haven't pled that there was a violation of international law in association or connection or in the context of those takings. Clearly, we have. If we look, for example, Your Honor, at paragraphs 42 and 43 of our complaint, of our amended complaint, 42, by 1944, the German experience in issuing orders made the genocidal process in Greater Hungary brutally efficient. But in no country defeated by the Nazis could the genocidal work proceed without significant participation of indigenous peoples and industries. And the work of rounding up the Jews to pack them into cars that were for the most part designed for cattle and transporting them to the east or west was largely that of MAV itself. That work included the expropriation of Jewish property that to this day remains in possession of MAV. The defendant MAV knew exactly what it was doing. It was using nearly all of its trains day and night to transport people one way to Auschwitz. The trains were empty as they rattled along the tracks back to Hungary. Without the trains provided by MAV, hundreds of thousands of Jews could not have been transported to Auschwitz. Genocide on this vast scale could simply not have happened without MAV. And then, Your Honors, I draw you to an individual complaint.
Are there any leases involved in this?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Leases involved,
yes,
in these cars?
Yes, we've pled, we did plead leaseholds. In fact, there were MAV workers who were Jewish who had apartments and residences on the property of MAG, and we've alleged that those residences, those properties were taken, property taken from those Jews who were removed from their jobs and then transported, yes. So rights in property is a key phrase here, Your Honor. It's not just property, but rights in property. And as far as tracing that property is concerned, we have fungible goods here. We have a charge of 3.1 pengos assessed against each of our victims for transport. That property has, I think, can plausibly be understood to have been exchanged for other property, just as you would exchange $1 for another. The key phrase, of course, exchange for other property, that we do not have to prove that they had that same dollar that they got for transporting Mr. Fisher, paragraph 1, I will read just again, tying his expropriation, so to speak, or taking into this campaign. I don't think it can be read without seeing this as inextricably connected to the genocide. Plaintiff Fisher is a U.S. citizen, born in Pitrev, Hungary, in May 1936. He sustained harm when deported by MAV in 1944, including the expropriation of his property and that of his mother, Irma Chaya, Shandel Fisher, Nie Hollander, and his aunt, Hedwig Fisher. Paul, his four brothers, and other older family members were pushed into a cattle car together with others forced on the train by the prodding of Hungarian bayonets. The family was ordered to leave behind the family's seven backpacks and two suitcases. MAV workers later boarded the cattle cars with sacks and forced him to hand over all items of value, including money, expensive stones, and jewels they had tried to hide in their clothing. His mother had divided these valuables among the family members so that if they were separated, the children might have means to survive without their parents. I don't believe these paragraphs can be read in a way that would understand what we've pled here as this taking as not being part of a genocidal campaign. Your Honors, if this taking is not wrong, nothing is wrong. This was a violation of international law. We've pled that, I don't believe, and what we've pled is certainly plausible. As far as showing that they still have the money or the funds, these are fact questions. And again, I draw your attention to that money or goods, property taken, that they still own it or have other property in exchange for that. And again, I draw again the attention, your attention to the definition of genocide itself, which does not require, of course, that there be a killing, but that the conditions of life be so affected that the group as such is no longer constituted. And this, and with respect to statute of limitations, it is a continuing wrong to this day. They still have the property. The banks still have the property. The peace treaty of 1947 that they're citing, I cite you to Garamondi, the Supreme Court case on this issue, reading from the Supreme Court in conjunction with Mr. Leon's statement, the effect of the Paris Agreement was curtailed, however, and attention to reparations intentionally deferred when the Western Allies moved to end their occupation and reestablish a sovereign Germany as a buffer against Soviet expansion. This was so until the final settlement. These terms were construed by German courts as postponing resolution of foreign claims against both German and German industry to await the terms of an ultimate treaty. So, for 45 years, our political branches essentially took a time out from enforcing the Paris Agreement. The agreement that they're citing to you as conclusive on the issue of whether or not reparations were paid was not enforced for 45 years.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
How much time does he have? 5 minutes.
Is it?
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Quickly on Mr. Pavage's last point, the issue with regard to the Paris Agreement, that dealt solely with Germany and the reparations to be paid by Germany. It had nothing to do with Hungary or the treaty regarding Hungary. But going in... Then addressing quickly the jurisdictional issues, what the plaintiffs urge or the appellees urge with regard to jurisdiction, I think misses the point. There is no issue that this court has collateral jurisdiction to hear the issue of whether or not the court improperly applied the or failed to provide the sovereign immunity that Hungarian Railroads is entitled to. And in addition, in their brief below at page 9, footnote 5, they specifically took the position that the analysis as to qualified immunity defense and sovereign immunity defense is identical under the collateral order doctrine. The issue with regard to domestic takings not being a violation of international law, I think it's absolutely true that the theory that the appellees now put forward would prevent claims being filed in foreign courts against United States and United States government entities with regard to takings that may have taken place in the United States, whether it be Native Americans, whether it be the Japanese Americans during World War II, or any other persons of interest here in the United States. That's not the law, and that would not be good policy. And it certainly wasn't the law in 1944. And finally, just to close with the issue of the treaties. First of all, subject matter, I believe, can be raised at any time. And when you look at the FSIA Section 1604, it specifically says treaties are going to trump any later enacted statutes. And I think that the allegations in the plaintiff's complaint with regard to the 1947 treaty and the 1973 agreement actually show exactly what I argued with regard to the conflict if you were allowed this case to proceed in the United States court. What the 1973 treaty was the United States using the resolution process provided in the treaty. You had direct diplomatic negotiations between the United States and Hungary to resolve issues with United States nationals. That's one of the things they did in the 1973 agreement. So contrary to it being an exception that would allow the expropriation exception to go forward, what that 1973 agreement and what the allegations in the plaintiff's complaint show is that there is a resolution process under Article 40, and that is the process that is to be followed with regard to the issue of reparations, because for whatever policy reasons the United States decided at the time, at the end of World War II, they put the issue and the responsibility for reparations on Hungary. And unless Your Honors have any other questions, I would ask that they reverse the district court's decision and dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. The court will be in recess for about 5 minutes.